Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today's date is Monday, June 6, 2005. Today's session is entitled Take Off Your Nikes, Corporate Capitalism Rules, presented by Larry Rasmussen, number RAL 2005-01.
I'm Larry Rasmussen, and my role in the village this week is to announce that we must keep the fire exits clear, all right? So these chairs, Dorothy, you'll have to move one way or another. I don't know what we're going to do for the rest of the hour, but that's how we start. I'm also just letting the tape ministry know that we're about to begin. Later on in the session, we'll be looking at a handout together, and I may need to ask folks to pass it along after they've read a paragraph, because I don't think we have enough copies for all individuals.
No, they're blocking the aisle again.
Oh, you got to move out of the aisle. You're right. I may be saying that all morning. Yeah. Need a clear space. Burning bushes are dangerous. Wrong. You just don't know when they erupt in flame, and we may need to leave here. Okay, let's begin. The title of this session is Take Off My Nikes, Capitalism and Holy Ground. And it's on the theme, Take Off Your Shoes, You're Standing on Holy Ground, which is the summer theme, and we're focusing on standing on holy ground this week. I want to ask what holy ground might mean. And we'll explore that with some artists from other eras, past and present. And we'll also ask the question, what might holy ground mean for us? And we'll get to that when we get to the handout. It's a probing question. Is it even reasonable or conceivable for us to speak of holy ground? Dan had the session this morning, and later on we'll be hearing stories from people whose answer to the question is yes. But I want to push the question. Consider this from Exodus 3, the text for the week. God called to him out of the bush, Moses, Moses, remove your Air Nikes, for the place on which you are standing is holy ground. Now, why is that a ludicrous notion, other than the fact we know that Moses is a lot older than Nikes? Nikes weren't around. If you said, Moses, remove your Air Nikes, that happens to be what I have on. What's amusing or ludicrous or inconceivable about that? What doesn't fit?
Shepherds.
Shepherds. Shepherds don't have Air Nikes.
Brand name.
The hype that went into producing the desire for the brand name.
More money is spent on advertising than is spent on public education from K through 12.
That's more than ludicrous, that's obscene.
Yeah.
There was a hand back there. You were pulling your yarn. Okay. any more What's the? Are there tensions? What's the disconnect between Moses, take off your Air Nikes, and holy ground? Or isn't there a disconnect?
Well, I wonder with Air Nikes, it's a symbol of our identity. You know, the types of shoes we wear, there's so many types and names. It has something to do with our identity. With Moses and his sandals, you know, I wonder if it was tied with his identity. It could have been as a shepherd. You know, it's just hard for me to connect that with Moses' identity, the way Air Nikes are connected to identity. Mm.
The shoes are fashion.
Right.
I mean, that's what John said, a brand name. It isn't just take off your shoes. Yeah. I mean, if shoes were made simply to protect your feet, we would have far fewer shoes. We don't buy shoes and wear out a pair and then get another pair. Yeah, some do.
It's a status symbol. I was just telling my friend, my kids came home one day from school and said, Mom, why does everybody else's shoes say Nikes and ours say JCP?
Yeah.
And the jig was up.
Yes. And you don't think of Moses as a fashion.
No, he'd wear JCP cast-offs.
Oh. Well, I'm not going to get into this. Well, maybe we should get into this. What would Moses wear?
I assume that what Moses was wearing was made somewhere locally by someone whose life was enhanced by his wearing those, which certainly isn't the case with Nikes. Someone far away, his life isn't really very good because of that. So.
Well, here's another scenario. If you say Air Nikes, every kid in the U.S. knows what an Air Nike is, but a lot of the young kids don't know who Moses is.
That's true. Another part of that scenario is that in a study of youth, it may be the same for adults as well, but the study was of youth, the youth could identify 100 logos, but could not name 10 native plants.
Wow.
Does that tell you something about what holy ground is and is not?
It tells you what money can do.
Yes.
In terms of education.
Yeah, that's right. They knew their world.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Marketeers had succeeded.
Another thought, just in terms of the holy ground. Today, I would say that probably most people think of wherever their television, wherever their VCR equipment is. When you think about what's in people's living rooms, what's in their homes, where is it placed? Think about your own home. It might even be that's where the holy ground.
Uh-huh.
I mean, in terms of what's the important, where is the place?
Yeah.
And unfortunately, that's where the media then has the audience.
Yeah. It's probably indoors. I mean, you're talking about something that's always indoors. But for a lot of folks, holy ground is indoors. I think one of the biggest mistakes that Christianity has made is to move all holy ground indoors. Now, not all strains of Christianity have done that. Celtic Christianity focused on places of meditation that were outdoors and put high holy crosses, carved of granite.
I was thinking that I went to a Jimmy Carter work project for Habitat, and we did a...
Can everyone hear?
No.
Speak up.
I went on a Jimmy Carter work project at Eagle Butte, South Dakota, on the Indian Reservation, and we built 30 houses in a week, and to me that was close to a Christian or a religious experience. And I've never thought of it as a holy ground, but after hearing this, I think that that could be, because I really was affected.
Yeah, that was in keeping with what Dan was bringing up in the first hour. Part of holy ground is the experience that people have in a place. He ended with being on the lawn in California and receiving his call. Okay, we're going to come back to this discussion in a different way after a bit. What we're going to do now is explore the theme of Holy Ground by way of a few artists. Now, the first artists are the writer of the 104th Psalm, which is a creation psalm, collaborating with a business fellow from Nashville, Tennessee, who's an amateur photographer. And I'm just going to offer you a 5-minute meditation on all ground as holy ground. And we'll start there. And then we're going to go to an artist, a mosaic artist, anonymous. It may have been several of them, from the 5th and the 6th centuries in Ravenna, Italy. And we'll work a bit with these biblical and contemporary presentations of holy ground. George, if you just punch the left one there and then hit it again for slideshow, just hit it again. To the meditation on holy ground, if you will, done by the group in Tennessee. Psalm 104, I commend to you. We only had a few excerpts from it. It's a long creation psalm. But it picks up a prominent biblical theme, namely that all creation is holy ground. All creation is sacred because it is the handiwork of the Holy One, the Creator and, strong theme here, the sustainer of creation. So one deep tradition of Christianity is a sacramental tradition that goes with the assumption that all material reality is sacred and bears a value in which we participate but which we do not bestow. And that deep tradition of sacramentalism is over against a notion that the created order is not more than utility for us, that its value is its value to human beings. Another element of Psalm 104, in addition to saying that all creation is holy ground, is that it is the whole community of life that is the moral universe. By that I mean we are a part of that and have responsibilities toward it. It has claims upon us. And much of modern ethics, including modern Christian ethics, assumes that the moral world is the relationship of human being to human being. And I think it proper to say, you'll find it shocking, that the status of the rest of nature is slave to a human being. The notion of stewardship is one you want to think about carefully, because the Christian steward was the slaveholder who was responsible for his slaves, to treat them properly. And and much of our picture of nature beyond human beings, we don't really even identify about it with it. We talk about it as something else. I talked to one person about this, and she said, well, our family just doesn't do nature. She didn't identify strongly with the rest of the community.
That's
But the status of slaves is this. Living property, living property in the hands of those who make decisions about the use of that living property in keeping with their, meaning the slaveholders, own interests. I just want you to think about that, because that notion of stewardship runs deeply counter to Psalm 104, where it's the whole community. You maybe didn't identify with that verse, "I will sing your praises every morning," from Psalm 104, as being sung by a blackbird. You thought that was a human being. Well, that is the reference in Psalm 104. But the picture is that the whole creation sings praise to God. So it wasn't out of keeping with the psalmist. And then the last thing I will say about that is that the prophetic tradition of Scripture is always a tradition of the redemption of all creation together. And the Hebrew Bible never separates the fate of the people from the fate of the land. They can be estranged from it, but that's what they are then. They're estranged. They need to be reconciled to it, but there is this even funny notion, I think, where Amos says, "Oh, you adulterous generation, look what you do to each other. Even the fish are dying." Yet these poor farmers, I thought, if I were a Hebrew farmer, I'd have a hard time understanding this. Why justice in the human community and injustice in the human community is directly related to whether or not the land which is provided for in a way that makes for abundance is abundant or is not abundant. It's because there isn't any way of thinking about the human community apart from the rest of the community of life. There isn't a Hebrew word to set off human beings as a species from other species. Adam, is from Adama. He's earth creature. Adama is a Hebrew word for topsoil. Adam is topsoil guy. Eve is mother of the living. So you got topsoil guy and mother of the living. And we'll get into this later when Adam, earth creature, earthling, is alone. Everyone thinks that the person created the next creature is Eve. Well, you got to go back and read your Bible. It doesn't go that way. The other creatures are created then as kin and companion for Adam. Doesn't quite take. But why? What's the logic there? The logic there is that they too are Adama. This is Adama. You are them, they are you. And so you have this parade of animals going by as the companions, potentially, for Adam, for Adam. All I'm saying is that Psalm 104 carries with it then these assumptions that all material reality is sacred, all creation is holy ground, that we belong to a community of life that is shared across the created order, and that this notion of holy ground is one which runs deeply counter to a lot of the notions of modernity, and we'll get into that soon. Let's go to the 5th and 6th centuries in Ravenna, Italy. Ravenna was a port founded by none other than Caesar Augustus of New Testament fame. As a military port, naval port, in the Roman Empire, and it became a major center then also of early Christianity, Eastern and Western. This is long before the split in Christianity between East and West, between what are now the Orthodox communions and the Roman church. But there is, and there's a lot of traffic around the Mediterranean, and Ravenna is one of the places of trade where a lot of this occurs. This is also a time before, just very, very early on, before the hold of Christianity as a state religion found its grip. And there are a lot of contending notions of Christianity. What became heresies are interpretations of what is the right notion of Christianity. And so some of these mosaics are of Arian Christianity. Now, Arian Christianity will be declared a heresy. Arius didn't think it was, just as Bishop Donatus in North Africa didn't think that he was a heretical Christian. But and that's another long story. We can get into it if you wish. But the mosaics are striking because they're both what became the Roman Church and Arian Christianity, and they share some themes. I won't spend much time with this because we want to get to Moses. But you will notice in the mosaics, as I quickly go through them to get to the two that we're going to focus on, that all of the colors are earth colors. This is not a time, that's later, that's medieval and Protestants too, Reformation. This is not a time when you have a notion of heaven and earth as different places, or you don't have a notion of natural and supernatural. You have a notion that paradise is here, or might be here. The language of heaven is the language of hopes for earth. And so the dominant colors are not the colors that would communicate to you of an ethereal realm. The colors are earth tones in these mosaics and telling the story. It is also, you will see in these mosaics, a notion of Christianity in which the flora and the fauna hold an important place. They are, it's creation-filled Christian faith. So,
can you flip the lights somewhere?
Is there two different thoughts in both from Psalm 104 and other places in the Old Testament where it's made holy and it's desecrated versus that God brings, or that it is made holy and stays holy even if God comes and leaves again?
Oh, that's a good question. I told. The goodness of the created order is a constant. Now, it, as in Isaiah, I said forget Isaiah, but don't forget him entirely. Isaiah 25, earth lies polluted under its inhabitants. The ground is cursed because they have broken the everlasting covenant, which is the covenant in Genesis 9 between God and earth. The first covenant is between God and earth. Check it out, folks. It's not Abraham, God and earth, the covenant with Noah, with every living creature, with all flesh, of all flesh. So there's a notion of the goodness of the created order that can be violated, but that goodness is not lost. I mean, creation remains good even when it's cursed, and then it has to be redeemed rather than creation becoming evil. That's an important notion, and it's one over which heresies were I mean, when there were great debates whether the created order is good or evil, and, the insistence is that it's good even when it's degraded. And then the focus is on how do you redeem a broken, created or cursed ground.
They both end at the same place.
Yeah. But what is important, and as a part of your question, is that the translation from Genesis isn't the most helpful in many of our Bibles, because it sounds like creation happened and ended there. Whereas in the Hebrew, it's things like, and it gets created, translated this way in some translations, in the beginning of creation, or when creation began, God. And it's a sense of, there actually isn't a Hebrew word for creation as a noun. It's a verb that we make into a noun. And we therefore tend to make it a steady state or an accomplished state. And so it's more helpful to think, as God began creating, the sense is that that goes on. And people pick that up. Augustine says, no way God could have put, that all the creatures could have gotten into that boat. So there must have been some species that started after that as well. Creation goes on. The dynamism is there, and a sense of goodness that carries on. The other thing that's important there in talking about holy ground is that human beings are a part of that dynamism and a part of that creating. And that's where the theme of a kind of special place for human beings as participants in the creation itself and the sustaining of it is a strong Jewish and Christian theme. I think it's a little bit much to say we're co-creators, if by that you have some sense of parity.
It's all me. What about man?
But there's a very strong sense that we're participants in an ongoing creation, whose moral responsibility is related to that very fact. So holy ground has to be tended. Holy ground must not be degraded. The holiness of the ground is something about which we have a part to play.
Well, where does the tsunami come in?
Yeah.
Is that a part of creation?
Yes, it is.
It is.
And the part of the sense of the awesomeness of creation that you get in Psalm 104 and the other creation psalms as well is that while we are participants in this creation, the proper stance is one of humility, that we are not in control of the created order, that creation is a vast drama, actually far a greater drama than the biblical writers had a notion of. I mean, we know much more now about the drama of creation. 100 billion galaxies, 100 billion stars in each galaxy. They're not even the psalmist had an imagination that could comprehend that. So we have to step back and have some sense of ourselves in a community of creation that began long before we ever appeared on the scene. We're latecomers.
That's expressed so well in Job.
Yeah, Job has the last three chapters of Job have the sense of that, even though he doesn't know the history of a universe that began 14 and a half to 15 billion years ago, and the fact that we arrived just a short while ago, and that we'll be long gone, and the created order will continue.
What? It wasn't 7 days?
It wasn't. It was a long day. I want to move on to the other item because our time is about up. And all we can do today is introduce it. I realize that's not an answer to your question, other than to say that this drama of creation on holy ground is one that began before we arrived and will continue long after we leave. And one question that we need to ask is where do we belong in a community that includes us as precious, but far surpasses us. Now the reason for the handout, to which you should turn your attention now, is one that goes back to my question of what can holy ground mean for us? The single most powerful human construct of our time is the global economy. When you add to the rise of capitalism, the powers of science and technology, you have the combination of that which has created the major forces that bear down upon our lives, for good as well as for ill. And I wanted us to spend a little bit of time with the connection or disconnection, as it may be, it's something of both, between the triumph of global economy, which is a triumph of global capitalism, and the issue of holy ground. Tomorrow we'll talk about asceticism and consumerism. It's a consumerist economy that has triumphed. So the question for tomorrow is how many shoes? We can only start today, and we only have a few minutes to get started, with a certain description of the global economy. And I'll start by reading that, and then you may just want to take this with you. If you do take it with you, and if you're coming back tomorrow, please bring it back. Constant revolutionizing of production, uninterrupted disturbance of all social conditions, everlasting uncertainty and agitation distinguish the bourgeois epoch from all earlier ones. This is, bourgeois epoch is the rise of capitalism. All fixed, fast-frozen relations, with their train of ancient and venerable prejudices and opinions, are swept away. All newly formed ones become antiquated before they can ossify. All that is solid melts into air. All that is holy is profaned. And man, language of the day, is at last compelled to face with sober senses his real conditions of life and his relation with his kind. The need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the whole surface of the globe. It must nestle everywhere, settle everywhere, establish connections everywhere. The bourgeoisie has, through its exploitation of the world market, given a cosmopolitan character to production and consumption in every country. To the great chagrin of reactionists, it has drawn from under the feet of industry the national ground on which it stood. All old established national industries have been destroyed or are daily being destroyed. They are dislodged by new industries whose introduction becomes a life and death question for all civilized nations. By industries that no longer work up indigenous raw material, that's Moses and his sandals, but raw material drawn from the remotest zones. Industries whose products are consumed not only at home, but in every quarter of the globe. You can get Nikes on Moses' old address now, right? In place of the old wants, satisfied by the productions of the country, we find new wants, requiring for their satisfaction the products of distant lands and climes. In place of the old local and national seclusion and self-sufficiency, we have intercourse in every direction, universal interdependence of nations. And as in material, so also in intellectual production. This is intellectual property rights. The intellectual creations of the individual nations become common property. National one-sidedness and narrow-mindedness become more and more impossible. And from the numerous national and local literatures, there arises a world literature. The bourgeoisie, by the rapid improvement of all instruments of production, by the immensely facilitated means of communication, draws all, even the most barbarian nations, into civilization. The cheap prices of its commodities are the heavy artillery with which it batters down all Chinese walls, with which it forces the barbarians' intensely obstinate hatred of foreigners to capitulate. It compels all nations on pain of extinction to adopt the bourgeois mode of production. It compels them to introduce what it calls civilization into their midst, that is, to become bourgeois themselves. In a word, it creates a world after its own image. Now I'm going to skip to the last and then we're just going to stop. And I said we'd read and discuss that for later. The bourgeoisie, during its rule of scarce 100 years, has created more massive and more colossal productive forces than all preceding generations together. Actually, since 1950, we've produced more and consumed more than all preceding centuries. Subjection of nature's forces to man, machinery, application of chemistry to industry and agriculture, steam navigation, railways, electric telegraphs, clearing of whole continents for cultivation, canalization of rivers, whole populations conjured out of the ground, what earlier century had even a presentiment that such productive forces lumbered in the lap of social labor? Yes. Now, who is writing? What's the year? I hear the right beginning. 1848 is when that was written. Okay, see you tomorrow.